Sahanavavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahaviryan karavavahai, tejasvinavaditamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi. Chaitanyam sarvak sarvam sarvabhutaguhashayam yat sarva visayatitam tasmai sarvavide namaha. Very good. Welcome back. Welcome to you all. Welcome also to our many students following this class online. We continue with chapter 13. And before we plunge in, there are several thoughtful questions that came that we'll address quickly before we resume our study here. First question, can the subject, Satchidananda, consciousness, can consciousness exist without an object, the object being born of Maya? If yes, if consciousness can exist without an object, then there are two realities, consciousness and object, and duality is falsified. If no, then your true nature as Satchidananda is falsified. So there's a lot of logic here. Logic is a powerful tool, and like any tool, it can be used to solve problems. It can be used to create problems. That is, we can use logic to justify wrong positions, and that happens to be the case here. So subject and object are related like clay and pot. Can clay exist without a pot? Can clay exist without a pot? You gotta think about this. This is some logic. You really have to think clearly. So can clay exist without a pot? No problem. Can consciousness exist without objects? No problem. But you have to understand this basic principle of satya and mitya. Related question, Vedantic knowledge is also part of the creation, part of Maya. So the question is, how can Vedantic knowledge, if it's part of Maya, how can it reveal your true nature, which is absolute truth? How can some of you can answer this question. How can Vedantic knowledge, which is part of the relative world, which is subject to all the limitations of language, how can that teaching of Advaita Vedanta reveal the absolute? Some of you can answer that question, and that is, it doesn't need to reveal the absolute. The absolute is swatta siddha, self-established, self-revealing. The teachings of Vedanta are used to negate your false conclusions about that consciousness and lead you to recognize your true nature, lead you to recognize an already existent truth about who you are. Okay, second question. Last week I made reference to mano-nasha, this idea of destruction of the mind, and how it's often taken in a very literal sense. In Advaita Vedanta, we take it in a secondary sense. That is to say, you recognize the mind as not being an absolute reality. The mind is no more real than anything else. Yeah, correct. The audio screen does look. Thank you for being so observant. Yeah, I had some problem with the computer earlier. And anyway, it seems to be working. Yes. Okay. No. I'm glad you're attentive. It's catching possible problems. We've had our share of problems. So we talked about Manonasha, and I made reference to this tradition based mostly on Yoga Vasishta, which really focuses on some of these teachings, which are actually contrary to what Shankaracharya teaches. We're studying Shankaracharya, so we can make a brief observation about some non-Shankara teachings, like Manonasha. The questioner brings up the fact that in Vidyaranya's Jivan Mukti Viveka is a famous text written by Vidyaranya. He says that Vidyaranya also uses the term Manonasha quite extensively, and how to reconcile that Vidyaranya, who is in the lineage of Shankaracharya, seems to be teaching here something that is contradictory to what Shankaracharya teaches. Now, you notice that we study a lot of Vidyaranya. In particular, we study his Panchadashi. And in, I think Panchadashi is some, 800 verses or something. Anyway, it's a long text, 15 chapters. And in all those verses, you won't find a single reference to Manonasha. You will, however, find it in Jivan Mukti Viveka, which is why we don't teach Jivan Mukti Viveka. Many scholars will question if these texts are really by the same author or not. And to me, that's the realm of scholars. Let the scholars argue about who wrote what. But for us, as sadhakas, as spiritual aspirants, we want to use teachings that are most helpful. So we find Panchadashi of Vidyaranya to be exquisitely helpful. So wonderful text. We've studied many chapters of it here in prior years, and you can find all that on our website, of course. And we will never study Jivan Mukti Viveka here because it's not as helpful. It introduces some concepts which are questionable and possibly wrong. So we want to choose teachings that lead us to discover our true nature as Satchidananda Atma. We're actually going to come back to that in one of the verses today. Okay, having answered those questions, we'll pick up the thread here. Yes, verse 19. We're towards the end of the chapter. We have several verses here which talk about the fruits of discernment. We call in Sanskrit jnanapala. Jnanapala, the results of this knowledge, the consequence of discovering your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. We'll start here with verse 19. Maranya sarva bhuteshu, maranya sarva bhuteshu, bodha kashchena vidyate, bodha kashchena vidyate, karma dhyakshascha sakshi cha, karma dhyakshascha sakshi cha, cheta nityo guno dvaya, cheta nityo Yoguno dvayaha. Sarva bhuteshu, in all creatures, in all living beings, maranyaha bodha. Bodha here means consciousness. Literally, it means the knower. And in our context, consciousness. A consciousness, he says, sarva bhuteshu bodha. The consciousness that abides in all living beings, the consciousness which is reflected or manifest by the minds of all living beings. He says, maranyaha buddha, a consciousness other than me. That mud is mut, which is a first-person pronoun. Other than me, nakashchin vidyate, there is no other consciousness abiding in all living beings other than me. And Shankara's use of first person here is delightful. We've noticed this several times. We could take it as this rhetorical device of letting Atma speak to us. So we could certainly take it in that sense. Atma says there is no consciousness abiding in all living beings other than me. Atma could be speaking. Or the other possibility, which I actually prefer in this case, both are right. It's not that one is right and one is wrong. But it's nice to think of this as Sri Shankaracharya himself speaking to us, as he spoke to his own disciples. So here he's speaking to us through his text, 1,200 years after the fact. So he's speaking to us, and what does he say? Shankara says, other than me, there is no consciousness that abides in all other beings. Or to put it in a, to remove all the negatives, I am the consciousness who dwells in all beings. So here, Shankara demonstrates the state we call enlightenment when your sense of identity shifts, gets transformed. Instead of identifying yourself with your body and mind and aspects of your life, here Shankara is demonstrating identification with one's true nature consciousness. Shankara being fully identified with his nature as Satchidananda Atma, consciousness, he can say, there is no consciousness other than me. I am the consciousness that abides in all beings. This is the jnana phala, the fruits of his teachings. And maybe you can see why I prefer the second interpretation, that this is Shankara speaking to us and not Atma, because he is like a role model. He's demonstrating what it's like to be enlightened. And he says that in terms of his view, he says, there is, I'll put it positive, I am the consciousness abiding in all beings. And it's very powerful when you can imagine Shankara declaring that. He continues, karma dhyakshahacha sakshicha. He's referring to himself as sakshi. And a special term we use, sakshi, you know, as witness. We put an adjective in front, sarva sakshi, the witness of all, the witness that abides in all conscious beings, that is sakshi. And karma dhyakshaha, just before I explain the rest of the words, Shankara here is paraphrasing an Upanishad, but not the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Many, many times he's made those references. Here, he's actually paraphrasing a famous verse in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. It's an important Upanishad, maybe not studied as much as some of the others, but still, a wonderful Upanishad. And he's paraphrasing a very important verse from that Upanishad where he says, I am Sakshi, the witness abiding in all, and I am Karma Adhyakshaha. This is a very interesting word that comes in the Upanishad. Karma Adhyakshaha means the one who is in charge of karma. Karma pala data. Ishvara. Huh? Shankara is saying, I am Ishvara. Careful now. What is the context? Shankara says, I am the consciousness. I am the consciousness that is the essence of all beings. Watch this. I am the consciousness that is the essence of Ishvara. That's the sense. Ishvara is karma adhyaksha because of consciousness. If there were no consciousness, there'd be no Ishvara. There'd be no karma adhyaksha, no ruler over the function of karma. So hear what Shankara is saying. I am that sarva sakshi, the consciousness that abides in all beings, including Ishvara. There's a tremendous difference between Shankara's body and mind and Ishvara's body and mind, we cannot say that Shankaracharya as a person is the same as Ishvara, nor is he saying that here. Shankara has a limited body and mind. Ishvara has a limitless body and mind. Ishvara's body, so to speak, is the entire cosmos. Ishvara's mind, so to speak, is the intelligence of the entire world. So at that level, there's no comparison whatsoever. On the other hand, the consciousness by which Shankara is able to teach his disciples is the same as the consciousness through which Ishvara becomes the ruler over the function of karma. Does that make sense? Let me just say it one more time, because this is a little subtle. The consciousness because of which Shankara could teach his disciples is the same consciousness because of which Ishvara can give you the fruits of your karmas. That's the sense. And he continues also from the Shvetashvatara verse, Cheta means consciousness, knower, literally. Nityaha, eternal, unborn, uncreated consciousness. I won't explain these words in detail because we've seen them too many times already. Agunaha, agunaha means nirguna. Consciousness has no qualities. Qualities belong to body and mind. And advayaha, non-dual, one consciousness. In fact, better than one consciousness, only consciousness. Because when you say one consciousness, and there could be, then there's a number two out there someplace, which is one of the arguments. If there is subject and object, consciousness is one, object is two. Clay is one, pot is two. We reject that. This is Advaita. There is the appearance of duality, but on analysis, there is only clay. In the same way, there's the appearance of subject and object, consciousness and the world. But on analysis, there is only consciousness. Only consciousness, adwaya. Notice, I think we've talked about this before. We don't call Vedanta monism. Monism is a philosophical term that talks about the one reality. Monos means one. So this teaching is not called monism, as some philosophers would misunderstand. It's called advaya, not two, for the reason I just said. If we could change it to it doesn't make sense. You can't say, actually, there is a tradition called Kevala Advaita. It's different from what Shankara teaches, so we won't analyze it. In fact, I don't recall exactly what are the specific teachings. But there is a doctrine called Kevala Advaita. I don't know about what it teaches, but I like the name. Kevala, only. That really conveys the right sense. Okay, let us proceed. Okay. Na satcha ham na cha satcha. Na satcha ham na cha satcha. No bhayam kevala shivaha. No bhayam kevala shivaha. Na me sandhya na ratrirva. Na me sandhya na ratrirva, na harva sarvata drishehe, na harva sarvada drishehe. This is fun, just to see something that looks confusing. Shankara says, aham, you see aham in the middle of the first line, aham nasat, I am not real, nacha asat. Nor am I not real, na ubhayam, nor am I both. We're back to this logic stuff. What is he talking about? You know, nasat, I am not real. So when you see something confusing, that's when you need a commentary. And that's why we have commentaries. Because Shankara is a Vedantic genius, and some of that comes across in his verses in this very paradoxical or cryptic way. And we may find it difficult to understand, which is why commentators will help us out. And this is an analysis that's given actually many times. This nasat and naasat is used in several places, scriptures, and by different teachers. So it's explained here by this Ramakrishna Swami in a traditional commentary. He says, sat means pratyaksha yogyam, that which can be seen, that which is visible, that which is tangible, is sat. Like what? Prithvi ap tejas rupam, bhuta trayam, the three elements of earth, water, and fire. Earth, of the five elements, three of them are perceptible. Earth is perceptible, water is perceptible, fire, obviously perceptible. What about air and space? That's the metaphor. So he says that these first three elements, which are perceptible, is what Shankaracharya means by the word sat. Asat pratyaksha ayogyam. And asat means that which is imperceptible. Like what? Does he say? Oh, no, he's tyat shabda nirdishtam. This is a reference to the, this is all scholarship, reference to the Taittiriya Upanishad that uses the word sat and tyat. And you have to have studied that Upanishad to make sense of it. Anyway, but he says finally, vayu akashatmakam bhuta dvayam. The word asat refers to the two elements which are not perceptible, the two elements being air and space. And then finally, he says, ubhayam means what? Both the first three and the second two, all five elements. Ubhayam. 3 + 2 = 5, right? Okay. So now with that understanding in mind, it's very simple to understand what Shankara says. Na sat, I am not the perceptible elements. Na asat, I am not the imperceptible elements. Na ubhayam, I am not any of the elements, any of the five elements. I am beyond the physical world. Now we understand. And just the comment then is, if you see something that looks odd, that happens a lot. And that's why we have commentaries. He concludes this idea by saying, I am kevalaha. There's that nice word again. Only. Only. That's that non-dual. One consciousness, better yet, only consciousness. And Shivaha. Shiva here is used as an adjective. It means pure, pure meaning consciousness that is utterly unaffected by anything in the world. Then, another strange thing in the second half. He says, may, for me, there is na sandhya. There is no evening. Na ratrihiva, nor is there night. Na aharva, nor is there day. For me, may, who is sarvada drishehi, who is the eternal consciousness, eternal witness would be a good translation here. For me, the eternal witness, there is no morning, evening, or night. And once again, it seems strange until you make use of a commentary. It's a metaphor. And the metaphor is actually fairly simple. For me, there's no day. Waking state. Jagrat avastha. For me, there's no ratri, no night. Sushupti avastha. Deep sleep. And for me, there's no sandhya, metaphorically, the dream state. That which is between day and night is called sandhya. Sandhi, it means where two things contact each other. So sandhya means an intermediate state, the state between day and night. So what is the state between waking and deep sleep? Dream. Swapna avastha. So with a little effort, a little help from a commentary, it's very easy to understand that what Shankara is talking about here has nothing to do with day, night, and evening. What he's saying is, for me, there is no waking state, dream state, or deep sleep state. There are no states of consciousness, which means there's no fourth state of consciousness. Everyone is so confused about this chaturtha avastha, the fourth state of consciousness. So, by the way, if you're a little confused about it, watch my video on that topic. It will address this confusion very, very directly. Consciousness has no states. Consciousness is unchanging. If consciousness is unchanging, how can it have any states at all? Much less three states or four states. It's not consciousness that undergoes transition from one state to another. It's the mind. You know that. The mind undergoes transition from waking state to dream state to deep sleep state. And then we have this term, chaturtha, the fourth, and that fourth actually refers not to a state of consciousness, but to consciousness itself, unchanging consciousness. There are three changing states of the mind which are revealed by one unchanging consciousness. One of the most important teachings in Advaita Vedanta. Watch that video if you haven't already done so. Okay. Then.
Sarva murtir viyuktam yata. Sarva murti viyuktam yata. Yatha kam sukshmam advayam. Yatha kam sukshmam avyayam. Tenapyasmi vina bhutam. Tenapyasmi vina bhutam. Brahmaivaham tatadvayam. Brahmaivaham tatadvayam.
Start in the second line. By the way, if the translation looks confusing, it's because there's a typo. Free from all forms, physicality, and duality, like space. That will make a little bit more sense. So like space is free from forms, like space is free from physicality, like space is free from duality. Sorry about the typo. So here, and that's what the first half says. It says, yet, that which is sarva murti viyuktam, that which is free from all forms, murti, that which is free, that which is sukshmam. Subtle here in a technical sense, as opposed to sthula. Sthula, physical reality. Sukshma, non-physical reality. Just like your brain is sthula, physical reality, 2.5 pounds, and your mind is sukshma, non-physical reality, 0 pounds, right? So these are our two realities, physical reality, non-physical reality. Here, sukshma refers to the non-physical reality. And he says, that which is free from all, like, start with that kam. Yata kam, like space which is sarva murti viyuktam, space is free from all forms. That's self-evident, right? You don't see, do you see blobs of space? We don't see blobs of space, free from form. Free from physicality. Is there anything stula about, does space have weight? Anything physical has weight. Space has no weight. And finally, advayam, non-dual. How many spaces exist? Space being boundaryless, edgeless, is all pervasive. That which is all pervasive must necessarily be one. One all pervasive space. And this is a very common metaphor for consciousness. Like space is free from forms, consciousness itself is free from forms. Of course, forms arise in your mind. Consciousness is associated with the forms in your mind. When consciousness gets associated with a form in your mind, we call it vritti. That's what you experience. Experience equals consciousness plus mental form. That's all it is. No, I'm sorry, I put that in the wrong order. Experience equals consciousness plus mental form. Sorry if I misspoke. What you experience right now is consciousness associated with the activities of your mind. But in the absence of mind, like in deep sleep, no forms, no experience. So this is the idea that just like space is free from forms, consciousness is free from forms, like space is non-physical, no weight, consciousness obviously non-physical, like space is one and all-pervasive, consciousness is one and all-pervasive. We've seen this many times. The kicker, if I can use that American expression, the kicker is in the third line, tena api asmi vina bhutam. And he says, asmi, I am, vina bhutam, without tena api, even without that, even without that, referring to the first half of the verse, space is free from forms, free from physicality, and I need to paraphrase this in order to get Shankara. Shankara is being not sarcastic, but he's kind of being playful here. He says, so I'll paraphrase. He says, space is free from forms, physicality, and duality. And he says, and I am even free from space. You get it? Sanskrit will obscure that very, very cute meaning, but that's really what he means to say. So space is free from form, free from physicality, free from duality, and he says, and I am more free than space because I am free even from space. Space, of course, remember in the ancient worldview, space was one of 5 elements. So space was considered part of the physical creation. Even science has, you know, the 4 dimensions, space and time. So even science considers space to be some kind of thing, not obviously a measurable thing, but an existent thing in the universe. So Shankara very cleverly says, I am free even from space. There's an interesting observation we can make here about the methodology that that Shankara uses here. And we've had several conversations about methodology in this class. You notice that we don't really discuss this in our Bhagavad Gita class because this is a more sophisticated topic. This is an analysis of how Vedanta works. And the distinction is if Vedanta is meant, if Vedanta is like a tool to help you discover your true nature, we could compare Vedanta to a microscope. And this is not a great metaphor at all, but hold on for just a moment. So by looking through a microscope, you can learn a lot. By looking through the lens of Vedanta, so to speak, you can learn a lot. But here, suppose instead of looking through the lens of the microscope, suppose you start taking the microscope apart and analyzing its parts. You're learning about the microscope. Now, there's some value in it. It's not the main thing, but you can imagine there'd be some if you're going to use a microscope every day, as Vasanti does, that's her job. So she's a research scientist in microbiology. This is her job. So if you're going to use... Did you ever have a class on how microscopes work? Of course. Yeah, 101. There you go. If you're going to use a microscope, you should know how it works. And that's what I'm talking about right now when I talk about the methodology of Vedanta, the method of Vedanta, how it works. So it's not the main topic, it's an auxiliary topic, but at some point it's an important topic. And that methodology is really shown here where Shankara says consciousness is like space in the first half. Then he says in the third line, but consciousness is not like space. Isn't that what he says? That's what it says. First half, consciousness is like space. Third line, not even space. What is going on here? This is such a classic definition. In fact, there are very few verses where you can see this methodology. Usually the methodology is over a whole text or a whole section of the text. Here you see it vividly in one verse, and that this methodology has a technical name, adhyaropa apavada. Do you know, that's such an important term. Let me put it on the board, just so you know this term. Where is the board? Oh, not that. There's the board. This is a technical term used in the understanding the method of Vedanta. Adhyaropa, superimposition. Apavada, negation. And I think we've discussed this briefly before and observed that the entire teaching of Vedanta can be seen as this one method, or we can say this is a method underlying all the other methods. Adhyaropa, superimposition. Consciousness is like space. Apavada. No, it's not. It's really, it's that simple. Consciousness is like space, adhyaropa. No, it's not. Apavada. This is, you know, that questioner about the teachings of Vedanta revealing the absolute. And this methodology of adhyaropa apavada is crucial because we know words, ideas, language, concepts cannot reveal the absolute. There's a famous statement in the Taittiriya Upanishad, yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasa saha, very often quoted. It says that the truth we seek cannot be reached by the mind or words. The truth we seek is unattainable to words and thoughts. That's absolute. But then, what tools do we have at our disposal? Words and ideas. So we use these words and ideas not to reveal the absolute, but to lead you to an already existent absolute through this step-by-step process of adhyaropa, apavada. And the best example of this, as long as we're talking about it, let me give you the example. Many of you are familiar with the story of the Arundhati Darshana Nyaya. I'll give you the short form today. The short form is how to, in a marriage ritual, there is a certain point where a priest has to make the newly married couple see a particular star in the night sky. Now, if the priest merely points to the star, there are a gazillion stars up there. How will they ever see the particular star? So the priest begins by saying, "You see that tree? Yes. Do you see the branch with the fork? Yes. Do you see the star in between the branch in that fork? Yes." And the priest says, "That's not the star. That's not Arundhati. But look over here. Look to the right. Do you see that brighter star? Yes. So do you see that brighter star? Adhyaropa, superimposition. Do you see that brighter star? Yes. That's not Arundhati, apavada. Look above it. Do you see that really bright star? Yes. Adhyaropa. That's not Arundhati, apavada." And like this, the priest goes from star to star to star to star, negating each one, leading them to discover the star which has been visible all, and this is a key point, the star that has been visible all along, but not recognized as Arundhati. This is the method of Vedanta. The truth you seek is here now, but perhaps unrecognized. So all of these teachings do not reveal consciousness. Consciousness is self-revealing, as we said at the beginning of the class. But we have to recognize consciousness for what it truly is. And what it truly is, Shankara says in the last part of this verse, he says, "Brahma eva aham cha advaya." I am that non-dual Brahman. Consciousness is Brahman. That's the ultimate recognition. And what that means is the consciousness present in your experience right now, the consciousness which you may have considered to be something very ordinary, after all, is present in every experience, but through these classes, I have a feeling you've gotten it. You know that the consciousness present right now in your experience is extraordinary, but more than that, the consciousness present in your experience right now is the reality because of which everything exists. That's the ultimate teaching revealed in Mahavakyas. One of those Mahavakyas, you hear Tattvamasi again and again, one of those Mahavakyas is Prajnanam Brahma. Prajnanam, consciousness, is Brahman, the underlying reality because of which everything exists. So here's a restatement. Is Brahman, and let's shift from conscious now to Brahman, since Shankara shifts to Brahman. Do the teachings of Vedanta reveal supreme absolute Brahman? The conventional answer to that question, of course, is yes. That's the purpose of the teachings of Vedanta, is to reveal the absolute reality called Brahman. And now you can understand why that statement is absolutely wrong. Nothing can reveal an absolute. Words and ideas cannot reveal the absolute. But it happens that absolute Brahman is already an existent reality here and now. It doesn't need to be revealed, needs to be recognized. Just as clay is already, suppose you've never been to any of my classes and you foolishly think this is a pot. But clay is already present. Even though you're ignorant of this fact that this isn't a pot, the absolute reality, clay, is already present whether you know it or not. Get it? In the same way, the reality we call Brahman is already present, fully present, whether you know it or not. Does clay have to be revealed? Certainly not. Has to be recognized. Does Brahman have to be revealed? Certainly not. Has to be recognized. Which is why the focus in this Advaita Vedanta tradition is on knowledge, recognition. Okay, enough said. That's good. Nice. We could have that discussion about methodology. Yeah, we'll continue.
Mamatma swatahatmeti, mamatma swatahatmeti, bhedo vyom no yatha bhavet, bhedo vyom no yatha bhavet, ekasya sushi bhedena, ekasya sushi bhedena, yatha mama vikalpitaha. Tata mama vikalpitaha. Mama atma and swataha atma. Mama atma, this is, we keep talking about your atma. Here Shankara says, my atma. He says there's a bheda, you see the word in the second line. There's a difference, an apparent difference between mama atma, my atma, and swataha atma, atma as such. There's a difference between my atma and atma as such. Let's substitute the word consciousness. The consciousness reflected in my mind is different from the consciousness that pervades the universe, which is a half-truth. In terms of your experience, do you know what's happening on the other side of the cosmos? No. You only know what's happening in your mind. That's the only thing we... In fact, you've heard me make this comment before. You don't even directly know what's happening in this room. What's happening in this room is indirectly known to you through your senses. The only thing that's directly known to you is what's happening in the so-called room of your mind. So the consciousness inside the room of your mind is called here mama atma, my atma, my consciousness, as bheda is difference, as distinguished from swataha atma. Swata means itself. Atma as such, consciousness as such, all pervasive consciousness. So we have an apparent difference between all, notice that word is important, apparent difference. Not a real difference, an apparent difference, an experiential difference between the consciousness in the room of your mind and the consciousness that pervades the universe. Shankara says this difference is in the second line, yatha, this difference is like the difference bhaved which exists for ekasya vyomnaha, you have to connect those two words, one space. The difference for one space, one meaning akasha, space. One space, vyomna is another word for space. The difference between one space, which is sushi, by the way, this is not the fish thing that people eat in Japan. Not that sushi. Look, sounds the same. Anyway, here the Sanskrit sushi means a hole or a gap. A hole or a gap. The synonym is chidra. Chidra means a hole or a gap. Chidra bhedena, sushi bhedena, in different holes. So I don't know why he uses hole here. The more conventional metaphor, he said, actually let's take it as this hole, because this is the conventional metaphor which Shankara uses frequently. Look upon this as a hole. This hole is full of space. If I had another pot, that pot would also be full of space. If I had 1,000 pots, every pot would be full of space. Are they really separate little pockets of space? Blob of space, as I suggested before? There are no blobs of space. There's an apparent. Notice we experience pot space. You can't deny that. If I talk to you about the space in this pot, you understand perfectly what I'm saying. So in terms of our understanding, in terms of our experience, we understand something called pot space, but this pot space is only apparently pot space. The reality of this pot space is it is nothing but space. Pot space is nothing but space. Is there anything about, just to make that clear, is there anything about space itself that got changed into pot space? Nothing happened to space, right? So the presence of the pot doesn't affect space at all. So pot space is words that actually mean boundaryless space. We can use the words pot space, but it's an apparent pot space, not a real separate little bit of space. The metaphor, of course, is for consciousness. You experience yourself as a blob of consciousness. Is it not true? Embodied consciousness, blob of consciousness. And we all experience that the same. And there's nothing wrong. Is there anything wrong with talking about pot space? Nothing wrong. We can appreciate it. We can experience it. In the same way, we can refer to ourselves as individual, embodied conscious beings. But we can know, and it's a matter of knowledge, you can know that pot space is the same as all pervasive space. In fact, there is no such thing in reality as pot space. In reality, there is only all pervasive space. In the same way, we can experience ourselves as individual embodied conscious beings, but in fact, there is only all-pervasive consciousness. That all-pervasive consciousness, which is manifest in your mind, and because it's manifest, let me just say associated here. It's a little bit easier to understand. Space gets associated with the pot. Therefore, we have the appearance of pot space. This is back to some logic, but we need this little bit of logic. Because space is associated with this pot, and the association is what? This pot is in space. That's the association. It's a physical association. The pot exists in space. Because of that association, we can superimpose potness on space and come up with this idea of pot space. Space, does space have any potness? Silly, right? Then why are we talking about pot space? Because we have superimposed the limitations of the pot on space. The limitations belong to the pot. Limitations do not belong to space. In the same way, just as this pot exists in space, watch this. Your mind exists in consciousness. Follow this. Just as the pot exists in space, your mind exists in consciousness. When this pot exists in space, we can superimpose the limitations of the pot on space and create this idea called pot space. In the same way, since your mind exists in consciousness, we can superimpose the limitations of the mind on consciousness. And that's what you do when you say, I am happy, I am sad. Because happiness and sadness are characteristics that belong to your mind and not consciousness. So the roundness belongs to the pot, not to space. Happiness and sadness belong to your mind, not consciousness. This is the central problem that's addressed by Vedanta. And Shankara refers to that in the last line of his verse. He says, get the connection here. I'll paraphrase the first part of the verse. Just as the distinction between my consciousness and all pervasive consciousness, that distinction which is like the distinction between pot space and all pervasive space. Let me start with this. Like the distinction between pot space and all pervasive space, in the same way, there's a distinction between my consciousness and all pervasive consciousness. The distinction between pot space and limitless space is due to superimposition. Superimposing the limitations of the pot on space, and here there is superimposition of the traits of your mind on consciousness. That's what he says. Tata mama vikalpitaha. The traits and characteristics of the mind are falsely superimposed on consciousness, which is utterly independent. And we'll finish our class here, but let's just conclude with a very important point. This is not some kind of fancy logic and philosophy. This is a solution to the problem of suffering. If you understand it properly, if you understand that the problems of your body belong to your body, if you understand the problems of your mind belong to your mind, and if you understand that you are consciousness, utterly unaffected by the problems of your body and mind, this understanding, this recognition, really and truly frees you from suffering, frees you from suffering. Consciousness, you, consciousness. Doesn't free your body from its problems. In fact, its problems are only going to increase. And it certainly doesn't free your mind from its problems. Mind has its own problems. It frees you from suffering. You being consciousness. Consciousness which is utterly unaffected by the problems of your body and mind. And I'm just emphasizing this point at the end because our class today has been very full of logic and reasoning, and we should never forget that all of these powerful teachings are not meant to train us in some kind of logical system. They're meant to solve the problem of suffering, as I've just explained. Okay. Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah, Sarve Santu Niramayah, Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu, Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet, Asato Ma Sadgamaya, Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya, Mrityorma Amritangamaya. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Om Tat Sat.